And welcome to the Game Audio Hour, a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio. From creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences to audio secrets, here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. This is episode 239. I am Vincent Diamante, currently trying to remember not to slouch in his chair because that just wreaks havoc on my shoulders. Not the best thing right now. Gosh, why am I hunching over? I need to stop doing that. But it's not just me here. It's also Alex. Alex, you're not hunching over, are you?
I am not. I'm nicely supported by my Norwegian Horg Capisco ergonomic chair, which is very good for my upper and lower back. Not so good for my bottom. It's not the most comfortable chair in the world, but that's the point. I think it keeps you moving throughout the day. But we're not here to talk about ergonomics this week because we did that last episode. I'm pretty well. I'm actually back from a ski trip. I went skiing for the first time in my life.
Wait a minute. The first time? Wow.
Yes. I mean, remember, I'm Australian, so, you know, snow is not exactly my thing. I didn't break any bones, so that's an achievement, I think.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's very efficient skiing. It's like, yeah, this is a good way to get around when you're on snow. It was not made any easier by the fact that I live in Sweden, and basically everybody over the age of about, I don't know, 4 is like this master skier here. It's like so firmly entrenched in the culture here in Sweden that basically everybody can ski. And we went to a ski resort, and there was like, it was a long weekend and just lots and lots of people, hundreds and hundreds of people. And it was amazing watching how none of these people, I didn't see any collisions between people at all. It's like the
wow.
It's like a sort of the most perfect NPC pathing algorithm that you've ever. It's like they're just sort of elegantly weaving in between each other, and there were no collisions. It's like a bullet hell game.
Wow, no collisions. What about for you? I know you avoided broken bones, but what about collisions?
I unfortunately did collide with one person going down a slope. He fell over in front of me. Also a beginner, and bizarrely not 4 years old. He was a bit older, but he fell over in front of me, and I didn't yet have the skill to make a fast pivot, so I fell into him, and we had a brief polite exchange in Swedish, and all was well. Anyway.
Oh, that's nice.
Anyway, before we get into other topics, just before we leave the issue of ergonomics, if anybody listened to the last episode, you might remember that I just purchased a vertical mouse, and we're now 2 weeks later after, I don't know, roughly 2 weeks of usage of this vertical mouse, and I'm happy to report it's been extremely effective. So
nice.
None of the weird tingling or numbness that I had on the underside of my wrist has returned at all. And I mentioned last episode that the top of my hand was feeling a little bit sore because I'm kind of clicking with my pointer finger on an upward angle now instead of normally how you would use a mouse parallel to the table. That's all gone now. So I guess, I don't know, I guess my finger is used to it now. So yeah, it's been great. And I can't see myself wanting to go back to a so-called regular mouse anytime soon. So mission successful.
That's awesome.
Anyway.
That's really cool to hear. Actually, I know we talked about it last time, but I do want to follow up and say that, this hunching that I have in my back, I think it's related to my ergonomics right now because, last time I mentioned that I have a Magic trackpad, and I realized that I haven't been using it at all over the last week. And that's because the Magic trackpad is actually mounted with a little bit of a sticky pad to the top of my MIDI keyboard, which I also haven't used for the last week because I haven't had need for it. I've just been staring at code. It's been all code for me this time around. It's all C# and Unity stuff and no actual music writing. So I instead of moving around my desk the way that I usually do, I'm just sitting in this one part of my desk in this one position, and that's actually the worst position. So I actually had to get myself out of that and realize what the heck I was doing, because in the moment, in the middle of just working and looking at documents and looking at code, I was so unaware of what it was that I was doing. So hopefully now I'm going to be on the mend.
Cool. Well, as Michael was saying last episode, when it comes to ergonomics, not only software ergonomics, but also physical ergonomics, it's always a good idea to every now and then in a busy schedule, just take a step back and evaluate your setup and your usual modus operandi, and just evaluate to see if there's anything better that can be done. So yeah, might be a good idea to see to that, and also maybe look at other options for a chair if the one that you're using isn't working out for you. And I guess the fact that you've got sore shoulders, that could be an indication that there might be better options for you. But anyway, so we don't die to talk too much about ergonomics once again in this episode. There was actually an interesting thing that I wanted to chat to you about. This is going to be a little bit of foreshadowing for the conspicuous consumption, which traditionally comes at the end of the Game Audio Hour. I've been playing a game, amazingly. Was released last year. It's a game called Citizen Sleeper, and it was released in 2022. And I'm quite a fan of sort of noir sci-fi, cyberpunk, ooh, space kind of games. And I'm also a huge, my first artistic passion after music was graphic design, and Citizen Sleeper was kind of a no-brainer buy when I discovered it recently, just because it's more or less you would call it an interface-based game. So it's graphically striking. It's a narrative game, so there's a lot of reading, but the interface design and the sort of the overall graphic design is very consistent, very refined, just excellent. Anyway, so it's... for those who are interested, it was released last year. It's by an Australian studio called Jump Over the Age, published by Fellow Traveller. And it is on Mac, Windows, Switch, Xbox One, Xbox Series X/S. I'm just reading the Wikipedia page here. Anyway, the reason I wanted to bring it up is I'm only about an hour through the game at the moment, but it has some interesting approach to sound, which I wanted to just sort of discuss with you a bit here. So just as a little bit of context, it's set on a space station, and it is a narrative-based game, and there's a lot of reading, as I mentioned. It's the story and the characters are obviously the focus here. And the interface itself, as I said, is very stylized. So, you know, there's a number of options when it comes to this kind of narrative game when you've got a lot of reading to do. Music is challenging to design in this situation, because on the one sense, you do want music to aid in, you know, setting the ambience and setting the aesthetic mood and the tone of the experience. But on the other hand, because there's a lot of reading, you don't want music that's going to be too dominant and too, distracting for the player. One option could be a kind of, you know, a drone-based ambient kind of thing, which doesn't have strong melody or, you know, percussive elements to really grab the player's attention too much.
Right.
Yeah, another option could be no music at all, which would be actually quite a sensible choice in a way. Citizen Sleeper does a really interesting thing, actually. One cool thing about it was, like we were saying when we had Martin Stee Anderson on the show, and we were talking about how his sound design blurs the boundary between music and sound design, and in a way, you don't really notice what's going on, but there is definitely a contribution from the sound to your emotional feeling. That was my impression of playing the game Control, which Martin had scored. And Citizen Sleeper does a similar kind of thing. So basically, so far in this first hour of gameplay, most of what I'm hearing when I actually listen, most of what I'm hearing is actually quite loud ambience from the space station. So it's kind of like, you know, if you're in an office building with a very noisy air conditioning system, it's sort of like this constant, you know, somewhere in between pink and white noise that's just constantly playing. And if you listen really carefully into this sort of bed of noise, you can hear sometimes sort of reverberant clunks and mechanical, obviously sort of sound from the space station itself. And one thing that's really cool is every now and then, and I haven't yet played enough to figure out if there's a pattern to this, every now and then you'll hear these sort of very subtle elements of music that just sort of rise slowly, stay there for a little bit, and then fade away inside this bed of ambient noise. And as I said, the ambient noise is quite loud. It's definitely the main thing that you are hearing. Being noise, you don't tend to, it doesn't really bother you that much. But having this sort of music subtly rise up inside the noise, never getting louder than the noise itself, and then just sort of gradually melting away. I don't know whether there's a pattern to it. Like maybe there are areas, because you can move between areas of the space station through the interface. You don't ever see your character because it's all sort of reading. You see really nice illustrated versions of the other characters that you interact with, but you never see yourself so far. So you can move between different areas of the space station, and I haven't yet figured out what effect that has on the music. But this approach is really actually quite creative. Like I would not have thought to do it this way. Just to have this really loud ambient noise with this kind of undulating, reverberant music. Kind of like, you know, if you imagine you were actually in the space station and somebody was playing some music in another room, that's what it sounds like. It's really quite cool. So have you ever played any other games, Vince, that you can recall that prioritize ambience in this way? So ambience is first, and music takes a second role to that, but sort of is slotted into the ambience in this kind of way.
I'm thinking about it. I'm not really coming up with anything. I keep on thinking about, I keep on remembering games that fall more into that first silo that you described of the music being more of this drone type thing that sort of melds with whatever ambience is there. But, you know, what you're describing sounds really cool. And when it comes to this game, do you play as a character or are you essentially playing yourself? You know, since you mentioned how interface driven everything is it ostensibly you, the player, that is engaging with the world with this interface that it provides you, or are you playing a character?
So sort of in between that. So at the start of the game, it'll ask you, it gives you three kind of like as if you're rolling up a character in a role-playing game, it'll give you three roles that you could choose between. And then you play that character just like a role-playing game context. So the narrative and the other characters that you meet that you're reading, they're all talking to you. So yes, you play the role of a character.
That sounds really cool and really immersive, and I should check that out. Did you do you actually have the soundtrack? Because I see that the soundtrack is available as a separate purchase right now on Steam.
Oh, cool. No, actually, I don't. That'd be really interesting to listen to actually what they did with the soundtrack, whether the ambient noise is there or not. According to Wikipedia, the composer was Amos Roddy, who I have not heard of. But yeah, that might be really interesting to check out the soundtrack. Just looking down through the Wikipedia page, this game is actually extremely well reviewed. It was nominated in the Game Awards and the Dice Awards, and the Game Developers Choice Awards as honorable mention. A lot of honorable mentions and nominations, Independent Game Festival, the British Academy Game Awards. Very, very impressive. Anyway, yeah, it's, I can definitely recommend it as something very, very different. I don't know if this is done very commonly in lots of other games that I just haven't happened to play, especially narrative games. But the only other title that I could think that is sort of like this is Control, with Martin Stig Anderson's work. But that's also a little different. I mean, Control, there is clearly music that you can hear. It's just that, you know, in Martin's wonderful style, the music is often very abstract and sort of blurs into ambient sound and the sound. So the music is first and the ambient sound is second. But so far in this first hour that I played, it's just a really interesting creative approach to have the ambience first and the music second as a sort of a hidden element inside that. So, yeah.
I mean, now that I think about it, I feel like this was an approach that might be that might have been taken by some earlier adventure games that I had played on PC, and I'm thinking about stuff in the style of, you know, Myst, Riven, you know, that ilk, and it was really quite strong. You know, that stuff. But the way that you describe it, I'm imagining Citizen Sleeper being rather more subtle about it, the way that it comes just over the ambience rather than, you know, something like Riven, which where I'm like, oh, yes, there are places where you hear clear music and there are places where you hear clear ambience as well, but not really that mix of stuff that has you questioning what exactly is the space that you are immersed in.
Yeah, and certainly for a game with so much reading in it, this approach is really, really great because not only does it firmly set you in the, you know, I am on a space station, you know, we are on a space station. You can hear the sound of the space station all around you. But also just being this sort of ambient noise is actually very conducive to reading. Like it does make reading quite comfortable and easy to concentrate on when there's so much text. So, yeah, in all regards, a very creative and a very effective choice for music design here. So, recommended to anybody who is curious, Citizen Sleeper. So, it's on Steam and also the Epic Store, maybe? Maybe not. Anyway, go out and grab it if you're curious. Highly recommended.
Looks cool. I'm actually wondering why I haven't been thinking about all the visual novels and kinetic novels and those types of video games that I've definitely played and been exposed to over the years because, you mentioned a lot of reading, you know, all the games that are essentially visual novels or sound novels or all those things that are really quite a story genre in Japan, but really only started to get a decent reputation in the Western world starting in the late 2000s. But even then, all the games that I think of there, they usually have very strong musical choices happening. Things like, oh, here is a theme for the environment you're in. Oh, here is a strong character theme for the character that you are speaking to. That stuff, rather than what you're just describing.
This is actually the first of this kind of, you know, reading heavy narrative centric game that I've ever played. Unless we're including Zork. But the older demographic of our listener base might be laughing right now if you know what Zork is. Outside of Zork, this kind of narrative-based, you know, reading-intensive game, I'm sorry to fans of the genre out there, but I've never really been terribly interested in them. You know, I've always thought, you know, if I want to do a lot of reading, I'll just grab a book, you know. Why would I want to do that in a video game? But This one, I actually wasn't expecting it to be like this, but I bought it because the design looked fantastic, and I, you know, wanted to support an Australian studio, and and it just being so highly rated, I thought, well, I'd give this a try. Mm-hmm. But generally, in that genre of those kinds of visual novel or that kind of game that you've played before, did you find that the sort of intense, you know, melodically heavy or harmonically complex or basically rather dominating, distracting music choices that you mentioned, did you find that that hindered or helped the reading experience?
Yes. It really does depend on the game. Sometimes the music does a pretty good job of telling you what's going on, and it might be the way that many of the visual novels that I had played, especially in the 2000s, were done as a result of a very eager fan translations rather than professional efforts. And so I found that it was really useful to have the music tell me things where the text might have been failing at perhaps communicating a particular thing, a particular emotion, a particular nuance with which I should be reading the text, for example. So when I played those games, and I'm thinking about things like, the literal visual novels of the late 90s and early 2000s, you know, Leaf and Key and those types of Japanese developers and the fans that translated that stuff, the music was actually really important. It communicated a lot of important stuff when it came to how a character was really talking to you. So I latched onto it and I enjoyed it. It would be interesting to play something that's a little bit more nuanced, that wasn't perhaps potentially limited by less than professional translations of those works. I mean, it's funny. There are a lot more visual novels these days. There's a couple that I'm interested in checking out. I actually have on my shelf this thing called Witch on the Holy Night, which is not just one of the genre, but also a big part of the sort of story of Tsukihime, which is this long-running series. I think it's been almost 2 decades plus. Yeah, I think it's been more than 2 decades in the making and in being delivered to fans. And this is one of the few that is immediately available to buy and play fully in English on a modern game console like the Nintendo Switch or PlayStation. So I'm kind of excited to check that out. Unfortunately, the little bit of time that I've had for video games, I go into something like Tetris Effect or Gran Turismo, where I know I can play for about 20 minutes and then be done with it before I have to do something else.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Not only the age, you know, how age affects your taste in video games, but of course also like work schedule and lifestyle. You know, I think at my age, and especially with, you know, with my family and work and stuff like that, I think gone are the days of just sitting in front of a video game for like 4 or 5 hours. Like, that's never going to happen anymore. I don't think. It's more, as you said, you know, like a, you know, quick 30 minute session of something, or, you know, I think in recent memory the longest that I can remember playing a game in a single sitting must be like maybe 2.5 hours.
That's a lot. I mean, and yeah, I'm honestly surprised, because I know that you obviously have a lot that you've been doing with your family, your wife, your parents, your kids. So, wow.
Yeah. That was I think it was Cyberpunk 2077, which, that's, again, you know, it's, Cyberpunk is one of these games where, you know, it's not perfect. And it, of course, its release was extremely controversial, and, And, you know, we've all heard all the stories about Cyberpunk, but still, I mean, just to look at and to enjoy being in terms of basically everything design, not game design perhaps, but like character design and, you know, environment design and music design and sound design and just everything. It's just such a, it's like a bullseye target, laser focused onto the bullseye for me in terms of the aesthetics that I like and the feeling that I want to get out of a science fiction based video game. But anyway, I digress. One thing I've noticed actually that is I've always found quite fascinating, especially having spent quite a large part of my adult life living in Japan, the way that Japanese game designers and I guess the way that Japanese colleagues in game audio in Japan, the way that they approach music design is often noticeably different, isn't it, from the way that we would approach music design in countries that are not Japan. I was going to say Western countries, but of course that's a ridiculous thing to say these days because there are, you know, there's wonderful music design happening in the game industry all over the world, not just necessarily in the West, in air quotes. But, you know, an example that comes to mind is Bullet Hell games. And
yeah.
It's a very quintessentially Japanese genre, I think so at least. And, Bullet Hell games and also Japanese fighting games, they have very distinctive sort of choices in the soundtrack that feel like, at least to the Japanese game audio engineers and music designers, it feels like a kind of sort of an expected standard choice that, okay, we're making a Bullet Hell game, so we need to have, you know, very high tempo, what would you call it? I mean, it's metal. I don't know exactly what flavor of metal that you would call it.
I mean, it could be really I was going to say some of it is symphonic metal, though.
I was going to say it's symphonic metal, but it's very frantic. It's often like with like blast beats and so definitely on the sort of what would you call it? The more
speed metal.
Speed metal. I guess that's a good way to put it. Heavy metal is like techno. It's like it's such a massive umbrella term just to say metal. Just like saying like techno is such a massive umbrella term. There's just so many sort of little subgenres with little interesting nuances and differences between them. Anyway, as a sort of a standard genre choice, that style of music for Bullet Hell games, it's curious to me that like the idea of, you know, when you look at a Bullet Hell game, when you play one, you know, when you look at them, they just look insane. There's just like, you know, movement across the whole screen. It's in a way though, I would love to try a Bullet Hell game where the music is the exact 180 degree opposite of the standard choice of that kind of speed metal, because Bullet Hell games often, at least to me, you know, you don't really get too fast moving bullets, because the idea, of course, is to weave your way through like this lattice pattern of this sort of curtain of bullets that are just, you know, covering the entire screen.
Yeah.
But it's kind of, okay, this is going to sound really crazy, but perhaps people who are fans of Bullet Hell games might understand me here, but it's kind of soothing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's kind of therapeutic because you're not, at least for me, and I'm not an expert of it, and perhaps this is the wrong way to play them, but you're not really sort of taking in the entire screen. You're focused down on a small point, which is usually the hit zone of your ship, and just sort of, you know, in very small micro movements, you're just sort of weaving it in and out of this curtain of interlacing bullets that are coming at you.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's sort of gracefully moving, and the patterns are obviously extremely geometric, not all the time, but mostly extremely geometric, and you're focused on this small point and just sort of making these small micro movements. It's kind of therapeutic, and yet I expect that perhaps because visually it's so busy, like it is the definition of visually busy, perhaps that could be the reason why busy music is has become the default choice. I don't know. It's like the idea of busyness and the idea of the Japanese term nigiyaka, which means like bright and vibrant and full of motion and dynamicness. These things and how they cross over into the music realm and the choices that they inform for game music. This is very, very interesting. You know, just like different cultures have different meanings that they associate with color, in the same way, it's interesting that the emotional outcomes of gameplay seem to have often quite a unique and interesting different meaning for Japanese music designers. What's your feeling about that? Because I know you've got a huge, broad range of experience with Japanese games.
The first thing that came to mind is one of those exceptions to the rule. Lot of these, Danmaku shooters, the curtain fire bullet hell shooter, they do have these really frenetic metal soundtracks. But for some reason, while you were talking, the first thing that came to mind was actually Giga Wing 2, which is an orchestral soundtrack, which is really, really weird and seemingly incongruous. But it kind of does a similar thing in the sense of not being a traditional orchestral soundtrack. There's a lot of just busyness in it. It's not classical. Right. It's not romantic. There's just like this busyness, and it's mostly this texture of sound that is happening in lows and low mids and mids. You know, it's just, we got thrashing strings, we've got thrashing brass, and it's like, there's not really that much going on if you're thinking about it from a theory standpoint, where you're like, where's the harmony actually moving, or is there like a distinct melody that's worth analyzing, or stuff like that. So it's orchestral as opposed to metal, but it's still trying to do a lot of the similar things that you just described. The music having a busy character to it that sort of mirrors the busyness that's happening on screen, and with that busyness, it's on the player to weave the appropriate path through the bullets.
Yeah, this idea of sort of visual busyness is really fascinating, because one of the things that I learned after, because I was in Japan for 16 years, and one of the things that it became quite amusing in the end was, again, this term nigiyaka, which is a very sort of positive term. It means like vibrant and full of motion and movement and sort of visual busyness. It's a positive thing, which is kind of a little bit contrary to what you might expect when you think of, you know, when I think a stereotype of Japanese aesthetics is that, you know, people tend to think that it's like minimal and it's like zen and, you know, it's very clean and it's very refined and sort of serene. Yes, indeed, that is definitely a very significant part of Japanese aesthetics, or one part of it. But things like, you know, pachinko, or things like, you know, as a funny example, Japanese web design is often far more busy than so-called Western, I can't remember, non-Japanese web design, let's say. One of the most fantastic examples of all of this was the supermarket. What do you call them? Like the supermarket advertisements. What do you call it? Like when you junk mail you get from a supermarket.
Yeah, that shows the you flyers all
that shows you all the different circulars. Things that are on sale. What's that?
The circulars.
Yeah, it shows you all the things that are on sale this week, right?
Yeah.
The ones in Japan, they are insane. Like it's just like it's packed from corner to corner with just like numbers and like call outs and like what's the term for like the star with something written inside it. There's a I've forgotten it now. It's been too long since I was in the graphic design industry, and I can't. It's not a call out. It's called a. It's not a splash. It's anyway like mm-hmm. that. Those. It's just like covered in that, and you just look at it, and it's like whoa. Like I don't know where to start, and it's kind of like a bullet hell game that you just sort of your eye is sort of tracing this path through this like this busy noisy labyrinth of information,
right?
And that I remember asking my wife, it's like how can you use that like that? Because again, from a West non-Japanese graphical design perspective, you would think that's poor design because there's no information hierarchy here. There's no, it seems like there's no consideration given to ease of use and efficiency in getting information. You know, a lot of graphic design approach, again, non-Japanese graphic design approach, traditionally, you know, the idea is that, okay, you need to think of your design work as being like highway billboards. You know, you've got like 2 seconds to get your message across before the driver zooms by and that's the end of it. So it's like, okay, what's set up your information hierarchy? What's the most important thing to say? How can you communicate that as fast and as quickly as possible before the viewer moves on? Anyway, so my wife said her answer to all of this was like, yeah, but this is Nigiyaka. This is like vibrant and, you know, it makes me excited because it's like, oh, wow, like activity, cool.
Wow. And,
you know, perhaps like the choice of music again for, you know, games, these kinds of danmaku shooters and bullet hell games, maybe that's part of that. You know, again, it's also, maybe it's not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily have to be metal. As you said, if you're going to have an orchestra do it, then make it frantic because that's Nigiyaka, you know. So it's interesting, isn't it? And now what about fighting games? Because I know you've got first-hand experience with scoring a 2D fighting game in the Skullgirls. That's quite hard to say in my accent. Skullgirls series.
Sounds cool regardless.
Yeah, what were your considerations when you were designing the music and planning out the, you know, the genre and the textures for that?
I mean, quite honestly, we wanted to maximize what we got because we had a composer that was on board and we wanted her to be in her wheelhouse and have fun. So, I mean, yeah, fighting games have changed a lot over the years. And I think even 10, 11 years ago, back when Skullgirls was actually released, it was a little bit more restricted in terms of what you could do and still have what was understood, accepted to be a fighting game soundtrack. We were pushing the genres a little bit by having something that was more jazzy. But nowadays, it seems like you could pretty much do anything all the time. And it will be great, and you just have to be confident enough with that. You know, Guilty Gear right. is all metal all the time. Street Fighter has had a long history of just playing around with different electronic music genres, going from, you know, jungle in Street Fighter 3 to more EDM and trance and all this stuff that we got now in Street Fighter 6, some of which is a little bit more throwback now that we think of Street Fighter 4 as being from the 2000s. Wow. So yeah, I feel like fighting game music is kind of all over the place now. Like there was a time when there was sort of a clear idea of what fighting game music was, especially with fewer games out there and most of those games just trying to imitate the leaders in the clubhouse with Capcom and SNK back in the 90s. Mm. But now it's a different world and anything goes, I'd say.
So just for fun, what was the sort of standard template for a fighting game soundtrack in those days? Like when as you said just now, when it was a bit more clear to people like what would indicate that this is for a fighting game. What was that template? Like, what elements do you need to have in order to capture that feeling?
Well, it's really one of two things, or maybe a combo of those, which is character and world. So, you know, you have someone like Ryu from Street Fighter, you know, the most basic and really kind of boring sort of character, really more an archetype than a real character, quite honestly. You know, hey,
oh, careful there, Vince. Those are fighting words, you know. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of passionate Street Fighter players listening to this right now. You better be careful there.
Well,
no, I know what you mean.
But yeah, you compare Ryu in Street Fighter 2 to everyone else, and it's that soundtrack that his stage has in Street Fighter 2 is probably the most reserved out of everything. Okay, sure, his stage is a dojo in Japan, and I guess you could do things to make it sound more Japanese, but it doesn't. You know, the sumo wrestler E. Honda, he has what is explicitly a Japanese sound for his stage music, because that's what the music leans into, but not really into his character. Ryu, as the main character, they give him, oh yeah, I am the reserved guy that does his thing, which is fighting all the time, and that's really about it. And right. Everyone else is actually a few more levels of crazy on top of that.
Yeah, actually, I'm just recalling. I'm trying to remember because I was never a Street Fighter player. I was squarely in the Virtua Fighter camp, and the one of the Virtua Fighter games I played Virtua Fighter 2 the most. My God, so much of my money went into that machine in the arcade. And my friend and I, yeah, we used to go down to the arcade in the center of the city after school, and we would just pump in the money into Virtua Fighter 2. And actually, that was the arcade, obviously, but we must have seen, I think, 4 or 5 bugs in the arcade release. Some really amazing ones. Like, I remember once, because I used to play Jackie, and Jackie would do his ending spiel, and something went wrong, and he ended up floating up into the sky, and he's saying, you just can't stop me, as he says, and he's like doing his kicks, and he's like in the middle of the sky, and the camera is tracing him up there. Epic. Anyway,
oh, man.
I'm just trying to remember the music for any of those levels, and I can't remember them at all, and maybe that's because I mostly played Virtua Fighter 2 in the arcade, and of course in the arcade it all sort of melts into the
sound
noise
of the arcade.
Yeah, exactly. So you don't tend to notice it that much. I actually can't remember the music at all for any of the Virtua Fighter characters.
I mean, very fusion-y. I mean, there's definitely some clear melodies that are happening in the stages. You had a very much that rock arrangement. So, oh God, like, you know, boom, do do do, do 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 do, you know, synths, guitars, rock drums. It was fun, it was frenetic. It really wasn't character themes. It was more like, hey, I think it was sort of matched up with the spectacle of the graphics and the hardware, you know, because back then, texture shaded 3D graphics was huge. And you know, you would do things like, wow, there's a little bit of lightning here, and you know, the camera rotating around and showing off the whole environment, and just having something be like really, you know, raucous sort of sounding. And it did a pretty good job of that, I think.
Do you remember the soundtrack to either Fighting Vipers or Last Bronx?
Oh, not well, no. I do remember playing them, but I wasn't as into those, honestly.
Yeah, I just remember, because I should go and watch some long plays or something on YouTube, because I remember Last Bronx. I'm wondering whether the music might have contributed to the fact that I just remember that game is just being really cool, and it wasn't just the fact that, you know, they're all using weapons, but the voice acting was really, really good, and I just remember it as being just really, really cool, and I should go and check out to see what the soundtrack was doing in that. So I don't quite remember it, but yeah, the It's funny when you just described there, very fusion-y. You got the rock guitar, you got the frantic drums, you know, you've got the synth
leads. Yep.
Don't forget, you got to have like a break beat, like some kind of break beat loop, and maybe like some record scratching, and maybe some trumpets, or I don't know. Often it's sort of a mash of different kinds of genre influences. In terms of frantic, the only game where I've actually effectively felt, wow, this is really cool in terms of that sort of frantic feeling in a Japanese game, was the soundtrack to Bomberman on the Sega Saturn.
Ha! Oh, man.
It was called, do you remember? It was called Saturn Bomberman.
I love Saturn Bomberman.
Yeah.
So good.
And that had, yeah, it had this sort of liquid drum and bass kind of soundtrack.
Yeah.
So extremely high tempo, but sort of smooth at the same time, like drum and bass and that classic original drum and bass style where it's sort of it's just smooth as opposed to being more abrasive like jungle and breakbeat and big beat were.
Yeah.
Nowadays, I believe drum and bass has also become an umbrella term, and liquid drum and bass is the modern day term for that style of 90s original drum and bass. Anyway, Saturn Bomberman had this cool soundtrack that was very, very high tempo with these drum and bass beats. And that was fantastic. And obviously, Saturn Bomberman isn't exactly a sort of a frantically paced game in the way that any of these fighting games or a bullet hell game is. But yeah, that was a great soundtrack.
I would say in some ways it's actually more frenetic because of how it mashes up these different types of musics together. Like,
right.
Because, yeah, there's drum and bass, and there's like some really like really at the time, very progressive, very, very new treatments of techno in there.
Right.
It used a lot of interesting instruments that like you would see in other types of electronic music, like Goa trance, and like Indian influence and Arabic influence. And, you know, before you mentioned that, I was going to say that there's so many ways to show freneticism in music besides being frenetic and upping the tempo and upping the notes per minute and stuff like that. And I think Bomberman actually is a really good example of delivering that energy and tension and excitement without just being, you know, balls to the wall, you know, music and layers of instruments and just sort of thrashing you over the head with what's going on and the way that you would with something like speed metal or death metal.
Right. So then what about atonal music? In the case of atonal music, obviously you've got this, the cliched stereotypical applications in the game world is for like horror soundtracks or basically wherever you're trying to create this, you know, brooding sense of discordant tension and unease. Is that the word?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just sort of setting up this feeling of discomfort. But have you played any games where the soundtrack is clearly atonal? And I'm thinking atonal, not sort of sound design atonal, as in lack of tone, but atonal as in, like, you know, the 20th century more experimental orchestral
Schoenberg
music.
Yeah, you know, Stockhausen.
Exactly. Yeah. Have you played any games that use atonal music of that style?
I know I must have, but I can't think of it right now. I'm thinking.
That'd be an interesting area to explore. So if anybody is listening to this and is just sort of wondering if something new and interesting that they might want to try for a game as something unexpected, you know, I think that when it comes to, if you think of music concrete and you think, we need Mike here. I'm definitely not an expert in the historical nuances of this art, but when I think of atonal music, Martin Stig Anderson, I guess, would be one example. But a lot of times we are using sound design. It's based in sound texture, as opposed to, for example, taking an orchestra and doing atonal music in the same way that those early masters of the art form did with an orchestra. So it's actually atonal, not in the sense of toneless sound effects, but atonal in the sense that it doesn't conform at all to traditional, you know, Western diatonic harmony. That would be, I don't have that much experience with,
well, when you say when you say it that way, I do think about stuff like Streets of Rage 3, which is like a very, like, if you want to just say that, okay, what the heck is this soundtrack? It follows Streets of Rage 1 and 2, which were very much electronic dance albums. And Streets of Rage 3 was kind of imagining what the future would be of electronic dance. And in terms of, you know, the harmonic palette that is there, it is very much atonal. And it was it was designed by people that were thinking about music in a different way. I say that as Streets of Rage 3 is famously attributed to Yuzo Koshiro, but also there was a really important contributor to that, Motohiro Kawashima, who is a really very avant-garde electronic music composer that just did some really interesting things in terms of harmony and tonality and texture. But this was a game soundtrack, and it still had a beat and a certain danceable quality to the whole thing.
Interesting.
So I think I would call Streets of Rage 3 an atonal soundtrack in many regards.
But is it atonal in the sense of just not conforming to standard diatonic harmony, but still it is, it's tonal in the sense that it doesn't rely on, sound effects and abstract sound?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, yep. Interesting. I have to check that out.
Yeah, it's a really interesting soundtrack, and it's very polarizing, especially since, Streets of Rage, really famous series, really well known for having really really great and incredibly well executed music for that FM synth chip on that Sega Genesis. Right. And then Streets of Rage 3 comes along, and it's really super ambitious in terms of its tonal quality, and some people weren't ready for it.
what platform was Streets of Rage 3 on?
Like that was also on the Genesis. Yeah.
Okay. So we're talking
FM synth, yeah.
It's also FM. Ah, interesting. Okay, yeah, we'll have to check that out. By the way, a quick plug for an amazing Plogue synth, which is called the MD, the Chip Synth MD.
Oh yeah,
which is their emulation of the Mega Drive or Sega Genesis FM chip. That thing is incredible, Vince. You have to get it. It's just so good. The Plogue's DX7 emulation is flawless. I don't have a real DX7 to compare it to, and some may say, hey, it's a digital synth being emulated in digital software, what's the big deal? But I'm usually not one to say there's something special about a VST synth, but wow, that Plogue's DX7 emulation is fantastic. Anyway, the chip synth MD, it's just incredible. Like because it's so grungy and lo-fi and emulated so exactingly perfect, when you put it through modern day effects of any kind, like chorus or reverb or any kind of modulation effects like flanges, phases, or just putting it through an EQ, it just sounds incredible because of all this like noise and grit and artifacts and stuff like that. So anyway, a slight slight digression there.
I need to use it more. I have ChipSynth MD, but the last few times that I've been asked to do something that is very much in that space, 90s game console, I've been using Super Audio Cart, which is a contact instrument that just has recordings of various patches going through a Super Nintendo or a Sega Genesis and all that stuff. And you know, I just tried to restrict myself compositionally to make sure that I'm doing things a more or less authentic-ish. Yeah, authentic Klish way rather than the real way, which is the way you should do it when you're dealing with the Plogue stuff.
Yeah, man, I gotta say, like that era, like the 90s era, sort of the Rompler era, and the, like, I guess after, we're talking a little bit later than the FM Synths of the Mega Drive and the Super Nintendo, but that era of sort of mid to late 90s Japanese synths, the really crusty, crappy Rompler era, sort of from the General MIDI and beyond, really culminating, I think, with the JV-1080 at sort of at the end of that era. Listen, everybody, go onto eBay or wherever, grab yourself one of these synths now while they're still pretty cheap, because you can get, for example, like the Roland D110. You can be had for quite cheap, or at least when I bought mine, it was quite cheap. And a lot of these, they just sound awful, and they're in terms of quality now. Like if you want to get like a realistic sounding tuba or a realistic sounding, you know, like a steel string guitar, mm-hmm. It's so easy to get something that sounds so real. But from that mid to late 90s era, these things are so useful for game audio. Like, just so useful. It's just so perfect. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, as we look at the history of game music and we look at the way that technology has progressed alongside game design and alongside, video game as an art form, that era of 90s, mid-late 90s sound really captures, like, a certain... I hate to use the term, but like video gamey feel, and depending on the needs of what you're working on, like especially if you're doing something that tries to evoke sort of an arcade feel, it's just so perfect. Or yeah, any of the Plogue synths or what was it, Super Audio Cart that you recommended?
Mm-hmm. Super Audio Cart is quite good at sounding like the Sega Genesis or the Game Boy or Commodore 64. But because it's a contact instrument, you can do whatever with it. Oh, you want to layer and layer and layer ad infinitum? It's totally possible. Which is totally not the way that Plogue works, where ChipSynth MD is very much what the Mega Drive was capable of. And it's not going to give you more than that unless you want to just... instance a few more of those plugins.
right. Yeah. Cool. Well.
Oh, I want to go just back a few because you mentioned Saturn Bomberman, and I was just looking this up. The composer for Saturn Bomberman is this person, Chiguma Jun. And if you go to the website, arab-music.com, that is her website. She hasn't been working in the game music world for a while. Instead, she is a classical performer of classical Arabic music.
Oh, that is amazing, isn't it? That is sensational.
Yeah. and she's doing concerts and touring, and she's apparently she studied classical Tunisian music.
Wow.
In Tunis. So yeah,
that is incredible.
That's why she's so cool at these other instruments that are typically off our radar, and we would consider, oh, that's an interesting musical choice. No, that's her wheelhouse.
That is amazing, and actually, it is timely as well because just this when was it? A few days from the date that we're recording, this was International Women's Day, wasn't it?
Yeah,
and so definitely a big lot of love and shout out and support and encouragement and respect beyond all to all the amazing women in our field of game audio and in the game industry in general. And also there's quite a number of very notable women Japanese game composers. I can't think of the right order to say that in, but of course Matsumaya Manami, of course, being another notable one who we met, didn't we, Vince? We
had dinner with her. That's that? Right. That was a long time ago. What, 2015 was it?
Yeah. I don't think it was that long ago. I think it was bit longer, further than that back, I think it was. But anyway.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's fantastic. What was the name of the Bomberman composer again? Could you just give it to us again?
Yeah, Chikuma Jun.
Okay. That is just fantastic. I love that she pulls off that amazing soundtrack. And then now, she may not be in game audio anymore, but she's a professional performer of classical Arabic music. I mean, that is just, that's amazing. That is so cool.
That's awesome. I know for myself, I know that there will eventually come a time where I'm not contributing music to games anymore. Hopefully that will be far, far in the future. But I also hope that after that point, I'll still be doing fun musical stuff, and certainly she is. So that's a great model to follow.
Fantastic. All right. Well, I guess it's that time of the episode again where we check in with each other to see what kind of games or music or literature or movies or any kind of media that we have been consuming in a conspicuous fashion. So, how about you, Vince? What's been on your plate in the past 2 weeks?
Let's see. Honestly, a lot of VR stuff. If the episode went a certain way, I might have asked you what you felt about how things were going with PlayStation VR, but maybe we'll leave that for another time. But for now, I'll just say that, oh gosh, PlayStation VR is really good, and I hate those earbuds. So, it comes with these earbuds that dangle off of the back of the PlayStation VR, and you can just sort of bring those buds to your ears. But honestly, they don't sound that great. And they're not that comfortable. And it's a lot better to just bring your own headset. It's rather different from my experience before with something like Quest, where there was built-in audio and it definitely wasn't good. But at the very least, it was comfortable and acceptable. So I could accept that compromise, especially since comfort is such an important part of the VR experience. If you're not comfortable, you're not going to want to keep that thing on. Now I put on my headset and I play something like the PS5 version, just updated Tetris Effect connected for PlayStation VR 2. And, oh, wow, what a game. I love that game so much. It's just so immersive visually, but also aurally. It's just the matching of the audio with the effects in visuals, which are definitely improved and enhanced over what I experienced before on PlayStation 4. It's so good. When you have visuals and audio that are crafted together like that, it's just an amazing experience. It could be abstract stuff. It could be the wind rising and kicking up dust. It could be dolphins splashing into the water. It's all these things. They just look and sound and feel amazing. So I've been playing a heck of a lot of Tetris. I think more Tetris than Gran Turismo. I think I mentioned that before, that I was really excited to get into Gran Turismo 7. But, Tetris. It's so funny. This is a game that's going on 40 years old, and it's people still figure out ways to make it so captivating. It is so captivating. I love that game.
Yeah, there's a movie coming out too about Tetris, right?
Yeah, I'm excited for that as well, because I know some people were talking about how the trailer really plays up the excitement and the sort of espionage, the Cold War and all that. And I've read quite a bit about the saga of Tetris, as well as other bits of video game history in the 80s. It really was that exciting back then. It was a scary and exciting and, a world full of potential and exploration, and everyone that was excited to get in there was really daring. They were really risking stuff when making video games back then.
Yeah, it's Tetris is one of those games where we often sort of we look over the fact that because it's such a ubiquitous, it's an iconic classic. Like, it is one of the greatest video games of all time in terms of its legacy and its impact and its influence and just its ubiquity in mainstream culture. And beyond all of that, the fact that it's just such a great game, just fundamentally, it's easy to overlook the fact that, when you consider the historical context when that game came around, and also where it came around and all of this. And I suppose if you don't know this, then I won't say any of it now to spoil the movie for you, assuming the movie is somewhat factually correct. But it is a fascinating story for sure.
Yeah.
Cool.
What about you?
Yeah, well, other than Citizen Sleeper, as I mentioned at the start of the episode, the last 2 days I've been really, really enjoying a new band, new to me. Seems like I'm very, very late to the party for this one, but it's a Baltimore group called Future Islands, and they are a sort of I guess you would call it British, classic British synth pop style group. If you imagine like New Order with Joe Cocker singing,
okay.
That's kind of what they're about. So it's sort of that kind of like new wave synth pop, Brit pop kind of style, but with a distinct. The vocalist is a very, very distinct way of singing, which really gives it a really interesting character. So their latest album, I've been listening to on repeat for the past 2 days. It's great. So yeah, definitely check out Future Islands. And that's what I have been consuming in a conspicuous fashion.
That's awesome. Is there any particular track or album that I should be on the lookout for if I wanted to dive in?
The one that I've been listening to on repeat is just the most recent one, which is called As Long As You Are by Future Islands. And in terms of tracks, no, basically all of them.
Okay.
Yeah. If you had to choose one, I guess maybe track 6 or track 7, Waking or The Painter, are quite representative of the style. But yeah, once you just play any of these tracks and you'll hear immediately, okay, I see, it's like New Order fronted by Joe Cocker.
Cool. I love that. Okay, I'm sold, so I'll probably check that out.
That was actually, that description wasn't my own, that's actually their description of themselves.
Oh really?
So I believe it was New Order. It was either New Order or like Joy Division or one of those. Mm-hmm. But that was their description of themselves, and it pretty much nails it.
That is cool. All right. So I've got some listening homework to do. And then, I guess before that, we got to finish up this episode, because this was episode 239 of the Game Audio Hour. If you like what you heard, feel free to support us by subscribing to us at your podcast purveyor of choice and leaving us a review to keep us in the forefront of the algorithm. You can also follow us on Twitter at Game Audio Hour, where we also post notices about future episodes, as well as try to support some other fun and positive voices out there in the Twitterverse. And of course, the easy way to do all of this without having to remember any of what I just said is to go to GameAudioHour.com. So go ahead and do that while I try to get excited about college basketball. Bye.
What?
Well, you know, it's March Madness, college basketball, right? Everyone's talking about, okay, well, maybe that's just my Twitter feed. College basketball. No?